Welcome to Steel Watching. My name is Eric.
And my name is Sarah.
And this is not really an episode.
No.
Even though it might look like an episode. It might sound like an episode.
This is not the episode you're looking for.
Yes. Thank you, geek. Anyway. We are going to take a one episode working vacation. Sarah, you know what a working vacation is? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Every vacation is a working vacation when you're a teacher.
Okay. So what is the definition?
This is when you take a vacation, but you still get stuff done.
Okay.
Or am I wrong?
My definition is, I was going to say, I mean, you're technically correct, but my version of it is everybody else thinks you're taking a vacation, but you're actually working just the same as normal. It's just you're doing it where nobody can see it.
We actually kind of call that a staycation.
Oh.
Right? You stay at home.
You stay at work.
Yeah.
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 So anyway, it's going to look like we're not doing anything with this episode. But we're using it as an opportunity to get ourselves back on schedule because things happen, holidays, family events, other things like that.
Tech issues.
And so we're going to tech issues. Yes, we won't go there. So we're going to use this as a chance for us to get caught up on our schedule, but we're not going to leave you totally hanging. Those tech issues that Sarah just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you remember we discussed them back in Sting of Steel and how the episode was really kind of a second shot at it. Well, we have some parts of that first attempt, and we cover a lot of the same information in different ways. So we're going to throw that at you, let you listen to that, so you can just kind of get an idea for yourself the differences between what we tried to say the first time and what we tried to say the second time and how it came out different. So, bonus episode.
Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes. It's the basement tapes.
Yeah, the B-reel.
So enjoy this. It's not going to be our usual marathon session, but anyway, have fun with it, and we'll see you on the other side with Steal Away With Me.
Welcome to Steel Watching, which is a podcast for Remington Steel fans. My name is Sarah, and I am one of the angry Canadian geese.
I'm Eric. I'm the snowbound Alaskan. Believe it or not, this last week here in April, middle of April, we had snow 4 days out of the week. So.
And right now it's 30 degrees Celsius for me and I am in a t-shirt. So I don't know. Mother Nature is wacky.
Yeah.
But tomorrow it's going to be 5 degrees and I'm going to be freezing again. So I'm enjoying it while I can. And we are going to be talking about the 21st episode of season one, Sting of Steel. So this is a fun episode, and it's a big one. It is, because we get Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and Beverly Garland in the same episode, which is just perfect, in my opinion. So my overall sort of general, or I guess macro thoughts, this is one of the episodes that I kind of sometimes forget is not a season finale. Because in many ways, this episode feels like a season finale for season one. So it being the penultimate episode, it always confuses me a little bit. Because there's so much in here that just feels finale-like. You've got the ensemble cast all with something to do, with maybe the exception of Bernice a little bit. You've got Abigail Holt is back. You've got two guest characters that are used extremely well and to really, really good effect. And just all of this stuff coming together. And much like Steel's Gold paid sort of homage to the treasure of the Sierra Madre, this episode is basically a reenactment of the Sting. And while I admit I've only seen bits and pieces of the Sting, I'm a huge fan of heist movies as a genre, so this is one of the reasons why I really like this episode. Do you like heist movies? Like, have you seen The Sting? Is this a genre that you're usually a fan of?
No, I haven't seen The Sting. I'm not necessarily a fan of heist movies in general. I have seen a few only because of other connections. For example, right. I've seen Catch Me If You Can because it has a connection to a White Collar, even though the creator and producers of the show deny that. It's pretty obvious. And also a movie called Bank Shot, which is written based off of a novel by Donald E. Westlake, who is a, I don't want to say he's a comedy writer, but he's a humorous writer about criminals and crimes. And that movie's George C. Scott and I want to say Karen, can't remember. I can't remember her last name, but it's got some big name actors in it, and it's a comedy type film. And so I was a big fan of Donald E. Westlake for many years. So I'd read the book. I was interested in the movie. I saw that. So that's really my only connection to these types of films.
This episode feels like a finale. It feels like it rounds it out really well, and everybody has something to do. And it's proof that an ensemble cast would work. That you can make an ensemble cast work. You've got a lot of characters in this episode. And like I said, with the exception maybe of Bernice, who is pretty much always underused, everyone has something to do. And everybody's got a part to play. And they all play it really well. And they've even got two guest characters in here that are not regulars on the show, but have significant parts of the plot. So I don't know, like I said, I don't dislike Steel in Circulation, and I'm eager to talk about that one too, but it just didn't feel like a wrapping up, whereas this one kind of does. It feels like everything's getting wrapped up in a way. Right. So,
And it does demonstrate that if they had wanted to.
Yes.
I'll admit it's probably a lot of effort, and this particular script probably required a lot more effort than some of the others as far as creation of it, the production of it, plotting of it, that sort of thing. But it does show that had they been inclined to, and there were not probably other pressures being brought to bear, they could have made Steel a good ensemble show. They could have used Murphy and Bernice much better and more involved than they were.
Hell, they could have kept Abigail around it. I would have signed up for that. 100%.
You're jumping to the end of this episode here. In my notes, I got that in there, but we'll get that.
Yeah, and I will say as well that the only other thing that I wanted to say before kind of breaking it down is that one of the things this episode does really, really, really well, aside from the ensemble using the ensemble, is that the pacing is perfect. Not a single word is wasted. Not a single scene is wasted. This is an episode that could have easily been a mess because there's so much going on and there's so many pieces, moving pieces that they had to kind of fit together. Whereas this, it just works, and it works so well that you kind of just go, you know, why couldn't we have gotten, you know what? Sorry, I just have to pause there. My recording got paused, so I might have a chunk of my recording missing. I just started it again.
Ugh. Okay.
It's only 2 minutes. I don't know if it'll matter too much. We can probably, if there's an issue, maybe re-record the beginning.
Yeah.
But I just
we can come back to do that if necessary. But no, let's go ahead and go on.
Okay, I still have a message here, though, that says audio input source has been disconnected. Recording has been paused, but now it's actually moving, and it looks like it's recording. So I closed it.
Yeah, my curse is continuing.
I think it's okay, because I'm getting like a timer, and there's time, and it's moving, and I can stop it. So theoretically, that means it's going.
Yeah, I don't know. It's... what can I say? Anyway, let's carry on.
Okay.
I don't even remember what you were saying. Something about...
I was just talking about the pacing.
Yes, pacing.
Okay, pacing was good.
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways, you could compare this to Steel's Gold in that sense. Because, again, it had a lot of complications. And even though it wasn't a bad episode, it was difficult to follow because of... all the complications. And the pacing on it was still okay, but yeah, it was hard to follow with all those people. And this one has a similar number of people.
Yes.
Yeah. But it works well.
It works really well. And I think part of the reason it works really well is because we know Abigail. And even though we don't know, I mean, for those people who are just starting to watch, don't know Daniel Chalmers, he knows Steele, and there's a bit of a shorthand there that we can fill in the blanks. So this is somebody who's from his past. This is somebody who is, you know, obviously a con man, and Steele is, there's enough there that sort of fills in that gap that allows us to just kind of go with it.
Yeah, we don't have to give the backstory to create the situation so that we understand it like we had to do with something like Steele's Gold.
And they're not switching. I mean, I guess they are switching identities every other second, but we're in on the joke, I guess. Whereas with Steele's Gold, it was like, oh, no, you're not this person. Now you're this person, and you're not this person. You're who is everybody?
Well, in this one, they're just changing their names. They're the same people. They're just changing the names that they're using to present themselves with. Whereas in Steele's Gold, it was not just that they were changing names. They were changing names to somebody else's name who was actually in the episode, who was using somebody else's name, who was actually, it was so very confusing.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, overall, it's good. It's done really well. So, we start.
Okay, we beat that horse to death.
Yeah. Horse. The casino employee is watching the thing. He goes into Hoskins' office to tell him someone at the roulette table is cheating. And of course, Hoskins says,
great line.
Customers don't cheat us, we cheat them. This can't happen. So then Daniel gets up, pretending to be beaten. He decides to leave, as does his partner, who cashes in the winnings. They meet at the coat check, and this is clever. They meet at the coat check and switch the bags. Daniel leaves with the money. His partner, who we later on here is called the Major, is almost out when the employee stops him and tells him that Hoskins wants to congratulate him on his, like, come on, who believes that?
Well, you know, at some point, you don't have to believe it. All you have to do is believe that if you don't pretend to believe it, you got a problem.
True, I bet. But I guess, like, at this point, they're still in a public place. The Major could have shoved him and made a run for it. Instead, he goes into the office, right? So,
yeah, that's true. That's true. Like, but, you know,
he's not going to pull a gun and shoot him right in the middle of the casino. In his office, on the other hand.
We presume.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes shootings happen in public places and nobody sees a thing.
I've heard that, but I've never actually... I mean, I've never seen one.
Or knifed or whatever, you know. People suddenly get blind.
That's true. So then this guy goes into the office, the Major, and Hoskins essentially basically says, I know what you did. I'm going to kill you unless you give up your partner. He pulls out a gun, and the Major gives him Chalmers' name. And, of course, Hoskins shoots him anyway. So... why do people ever trust bad guys when they say they're going to let them live?
I don't know. I guess it has to do with the moral standards of the person who is doing the trusting. You know, you don't want to believe that anybody would really do that. I mean, in cold blood, come on. Nobody would do that. Well, they do that. And... I guess that's just a frailty of human nature to want to trust people to have the same moral standards that you do and expect them to behave in the same way you would and not be able to conceive of somebody saying, no, I have no moral standards whatsoever.
And it's one of those tropes that we see in almost every sort of action film or movie that is like this, where you get the bad guy reveals his scheme and, you know, one person who has some morals stands up and says, I can't be a part of this. And they're like, oh, absolutely. If I respect your decision. And then they shoot them in the back as they walk out the door. Right.
So right.
We all saw this coming.
Mm-hmm. But, well, first of all, would a casino take a bet that they couldn't cover? And if somebody did come in and want to place a bet,
that large, the table operator would probably have to get permission from the manager to accept it. They probably have a limit in order to prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
So right away, there's something wrong with the story.
And that was the question I had written down was, should Hoskins have been a red flag at this point? Because there's so much here. And the language, like the ambiguous, I want to give him what's coming to him. This is another trope that kind of bugs me. And overall, it doesn't bother the episode. The episode is still as good as it is. But this is a trope I see in other TV shows and things. Buffy did it, for example, where you've got to misdirect and you've got to use language that's vague in order to make the misdirect work. Right. Because he's not going to say to Laura, like, I need to find Chalmers so I can put a bullet through his through his head. That's clearly not. But he could just as easily he could have just as easily have said, I want to find Chalmers so I can repay him the money I owe him. Give him what's coming to him is kind of like saying, have the day you deserve. There's a very clear implication behind that. So I don't know.
It's said in a certain way, knowing that the other person will interpret it in a way that they want to, but that doesn't necessarily, what they're saying doesn't necessarily mean what the other person, what the other person says it or thinks it means.
Yes.
But they're saying something that they know the other person is going to think means something that it doesn't necessarily mean. I think I've said better that time.
We got there. But yeah, so I don't know. I don't think at this point it's enough for Laura to not take the case, but I would be a little suspicious right off the get-go, because it's not like they've never been hired by dishonest people before.
Right.
Right. So, but
and when somebody's working that hard not to say something directly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If not a red flag, at least a yellow flag.
Yeah. Well, if we're talking soccer, which we will, is a yellow card.
It's not soccer. Well, and that was one of my notes.
Yes. Yes. It's one of mine too. We'll get there. Either way, he tells Laura that his sources tell him that he's coming this way. He likes to live high off the hog. And before they can get any further, Bernice buzzes and tells her that she has good news and bad news. And Laura opts for the good news first, to which Bernice tells her that Steele has called in sick. The bad news is apparently that Laura's mother is here. And immediately the music changes, which is a really nice touch, as is the look of absolute horror on Laura's face. Like, this is perfect from Stephanie. She just, it's great. It's a great little moment there, because she leaves the office. She's panicked and finds Abigail Holt sitting on the sofa, fresh off a breakup.
Can we, before we get into Abigail, can we hop back a little bit?
Sure.
Because there's a line in there that I think some people may not register correctly. And I think a lot of people do, but I'm gonna presume that there's a few that don't, especially if they don't watch British TV.
Like, right.
Hercule Poirot.
I watch a lot of British TV, so this might not have even occurred to me.
Restaurants.
That I didn't even think would be a confusing thing, because I watch a ton of British TV. And yeah.
Well, as do I. Again, I'm a huge fan of the Hercule Poirot. Boy, I have so much trouble saying his name. But, you know, he's always being assumed to be a Frenchman, because he's Belgian and he speaks a version of French. And I remember in one episode that somebody called him a bloody little frog. And his response was, I'm not a bloody little frog. I'm a bloody little Belgian. And in the context of this episode, frog restaurants, there might be some folks out there thinking that it's a restaurant that serves frog legs.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's a dismissive term for the French.
Yes.
Used by the British or the English.
Yes.
And I did a little research on it just because I was curious about it. And there's apparently a couple different possible sources for that term. And one is, let's see, from the Dictionary of Phrase and Fable in 1898, there's a quote of a phrase, "What will the frogs or the people of Paris say?" And apparently at that time in the area of Paris, there was a place known as Lutetia, I guess, which means mud land, and it was surrounded by swamps, and frogs lived in the swamps. So there is that as a possibility. And then also has something to do with the heraldry of King Clovis, who had three frogs on his heraldic shield and flag, at least until he converted Christianity, and then he adopted the fleur-de-lis. So, yeah. And apparently Nostradamus also referred to them in such terms. Yeah, it's just a dismissive term used by some English people, British people, to refer to French people. So for anybody who didn't understand that reference, who thought they were talking about frog legs at a restaurant, now you know.
Yeah, and it's there's a few terms and English-isms that are used in this episode, and things that are kind of either wrong or right. So not sure how much they did their homework when it comes to some of it. But yeah, the frog thing, I didn't even... did you know that, for example, in Canada, some of derogatory terms that are used to refer to people from Quebec are like Pepsi? Because it...
Pepsi? As in the cola drink Pepsi?
As in the soft drink, yeah. So this was a term that was kind of used as a slur because... in the late 40s, the assumption was that they were too poor to afford Coke, which was marginally more expensive. So Pepsi's early marketing promoted itself as like the cheaper alternative, like twice as much for a nickel. Pepsi is the drink for you, sort of thing. So it was more common, and it was used as well as pea soup, because pea soup was another. It was so. Yeah, it's if you don't understand some of the more localism references, and that's Quebec French, not France French, so it's different. But yeah, I did notice that, but I honestly didn't make a note about it because it didn't occur to me. So good job. The other thing that I thought was interesting, Bernice says Skeezix is out with a cold, and I was curious, so I looked up the origin of the word, and I had actually a bit of trouble. Do you know the origin of this word, where it comes from?
No, I also looked it up.
Okay.
And what I found was a couple of different things. First of all, that the word itself means rascal or rogue.
Yes.
Contemptible fellow.
I saw that.
A word of unknown origin, perhaps a fanciful formation. By the early 20th century,
okay.
It was often used affectionately or playfully of children. Now, there's another reference I found, and it refers to a comic strip called Gasoline Alley.
I found this too.
Which was a comic strip created in 1919, and one of the characters had a baby. And they named it Skeezix. And the reference in, this is on Britannica.com, so it's Encyclopedia Britannica. So you would think it has some accuracy, but, you know, sometimes the accuracy is not so much in the base fact, but accuracy in repeating what you've been told, even though the base fact of what you've been told might be wrong. Their reference is that it's a cowboy slang term for an orphan calf, which I found absolutely no evidence of.
No, and so you had the same problem I did. I probably spent like half an hour trying to find more information on this gasoline alley or the origin of this word, and it was very difficult, and which is funny because we often think of Google as having the answers to everything. I mean, you get a cold and Google will tell you you're dying of cancer, but I couldn't find you know, you go down Dr. Google's route and end up with some bizarre disease the CDC's never heard of, but I could not find I had a hell of a time with this word, and it I don't know. I just found it really interesting because usually you can find etymology on words on the internet, but that one was a hard one. Which makes it interesting that they chose to use it too, because it must have been at least well known enough in the 80s that it was.
Maybe he was a fan of Gasoline Alley or had read it when he was a kid.
Yeah. But I remember hearing my dad use it too. In that sort of rascal and contemptible fellow sort of way. So, and that's clearly how Bernice means it, because she skis it because that was a cold. Right? So,
30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Think about it. It's a movie, 1944 movie, based on the 1943 book of the same name, which is the story of the Doolittle raid on Japan shortly after the war started. They were using prop planes, prop airplanes. The engines, when you're hearing them, do not sound anything like a jet engine when you're hearing them. Totally different sound. Even over the phone, you can tell the difference. How could Laura not tell the difference?
I know. I guess she's, again, we could make the argument that she's distracted by her mother, right? So.
Okay. But we'll go with that.
So he tells Laura it's time to take his medication and begs her not to come and see him, as one of us has to stay healthy. Such a generous fellow. When he hangs up, he comments on how wonderful call forwarding is, and it's apparent that he has done so and has had his calls forwarded to the limo. So, okay, and this is where, this isn't a dig, but I was an infant, so I don't know how this would have worked. So was this a thing? Like, we just watched a movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It came out in 1995. Last night we watched Johnny Mnemonic with Keanu Reeves. And it was one of those like cyberpunk movies that was set in the quote unquote distant future, i.e. 2021. And it was one of those movies that had a bunch of technology that didn't really exist yet, but kind of did. And they sort of played with it. So I'm wondering, is this one of those instances where they're taking something that sort of existed and making it do more than it could? Or was that genuinely a thing? Could you do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you could do that. You had to type in a code, and I don't remember what it was now. It was so long ago. Although I think you could still do it even on cell phones now. But yes, you could have your calls forwarded from one number to another number. Of course, it originally started internally with in-house telephone systems. So you had this massive telephone system, and you could transfer it from one extension to the other, you know, with an auto forward. But yes, call forwarding was a thing.
Okay.
And it would have been able, I'm sure you would have been able to do it to a mobile phone like this as well as a landline.
I mean, he's kind of risking it getting found out if Fred mentions it, but.
It's not Fred.
Oh, isn't it? I didn't even notice.
No. Is it someone else? I noticed that Fred is not in this episode. No. I don't know who that guy is, but he's not Fred. And they need to bring Fred back.
Did he swipe the limo? Did he just like straight up like steal it and hire his own dude?
Hey, he gave Fred the day off and brought somebody else in.
Yeah.
Who didn't know any better.
Okay.
Didn't know Laura and wouldn't go running to Laura or let something slip. That's
wow.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's probably what happened.
Yeah, because to be honest, I wasn't even looking to see who was behind the wheel, right? Like, I was just kind of focused on, like, what was going on with the phone call and stuff. So it didn't occur to me.
I really wasn't noticing it either. But when I was watching it and taking notes, it was like, wait a second. And I actually had to go back and slow play it and pause it to look. And it's not Fred anywhere in this episode.
That's crazy.
Yes.
Okay. Smart. Steel is getting smarter with his deceptions.
Yeah.
And then we've got Laura going into the office where Abigail has calmed herself. and asks what's wrong. Abigail does her usual passive-aggressive response of, oh, I don't want to burden you. To which, you know, Laura says it's more of a burden not knowing. And Abigail tells her that she hasn't been in a relationship for a while until she met Dr. Harvey Fetterman, a children's orthodontist. Oh, those tiny little teeth. She claims they met at a seminar on plaque. And here's my question, because she says, you know, I like to keep current. And it seems to me, in most of the fan fiction that I've read, and everything that I've read about Abigail's backstory, is that at one time she worked as a dental assistant of some sort. Mm-hmm. And this
hygienist
line,
is my guess.
Yeah, this line sort of seems to hint that way. Mm-hmm. Is that fanon or canon?
What do you mean, is it fanon or canon?
So I mean, fanon is when
Yeah, I understand the question. I don't understand the context of the question, because here in the script, she attended a dental conference with Darby, where she met Dr. Harvey Fetterman, and she likes to keep current, which means that she is in the dental profession either as a hygienist or a dentist or in some other professional capacity. So, I mean, it's right there in the episode.
Okay. So,
the details as to whether she's a hygienist or a receptionist or a lab tech or whatever, then we get into the fanon.
Okay.
But that she's in the dental profession is canon.
I just wasn't sure if it was one of those, like, I went to a conference, because sometimes you get old, and not even just older, but people who like to know things in all sorts of capacities and all sorts of topics. And so they'll attend like talks and conferences and things like that. So I wasn't sure if it was just one of those, like, she's retired, and so she just, quote, likes to keep current, i.e. something was in town and she went to it, or this was a former profession of hers and she was attending as a person who was trying to keep up to date.
I understand what you're saying, but I don't think this type of a seminar would be the kind of thing where you would allow civilians in.
True.
You would have to be a certified member of the dental profession in some capacity. Okay. And this would be relevant to your profession. That's how I read it. I could be wrong, but that's how I read it.
That makes sense. It was one of those things where I don't think it was ever explicitly said. Aside from that line, we don't know what she did specifically. And Laura never really says. Laura just talks about her mother's reaction to her father leaving, but never talks about, obviously, they would have had to make money somehow. So, I guess
it's interesting that they take this about Abigail and Dr. Harvey Fetterman, and then they transfer it over to Donald and Francine.
Yes.
But isn't Abigail a drama queen and kind of like the female version of Remington Steele?
Yes.
As far as her drama queenness.
Oh my God, she is. Yes, absolutely. And I guess she grates on Laura's nerves the same way that Mr. Steele does when he's, you know, going off on a tangent, right? So,
and making up some bizarre story and trying to get sympathy. Yeah. That's exactly what she's doing here. Yeah.
And then she says that before they could go, he proposed, and Laura immediately thinks that she needs marriage, that they bring his wife along so that they could get to know each other. I'm going to say something here about people I know in my personal life. I have a lot of friends that are polyamorous, that have more than one partner, right? And are open about that. Did Abigail misread this situation? Was she ever in an actual relationship? Or, like, did he just view her as a colleague? Or was this a situation of Harvey hoping to get some sort of threesome or polyamorous relationship? Like, I don't understand how you could invite your wife along with your girlfriend and want them to get to know each other unless you were A, trying to get to know each other, or B, that there wasn't an actual relationship and Abigail just thought there was.
Well, knowing what we do about Abigail, the second is entirely possible, but Yeah, what I've got written down here, get to know one another, ? Don't even want to know what the good doctor really had in mind, right? Because I'm going for the first. I'm going for, hey, let's bring my wife along and let's all get to know each other. It's like, okay, yeah, I know where that's going.
I think so too. And she even says, I couldn't be a good sport about it. I mean, you can't blame her if she was not aware that that's what Harvey had in mind, that might hurt some people mm-hmm. the wrong way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially if he kind of kept the fact that he was married a secret up to that point.
Yeah. Which, and that was the only thing that led me to think maybe it was the former, that maybe they were professional colleagues / friends. And he maybe said, hey, there's this thing in town you might want. I guess she thinks they're going for just a weekend away, but like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It just feels to me that
back then in 1983, back in the day. Yeah. I think most men who were married, most women who were married wore a ring. I can't imagine Abigail not noticing if he was wearing a ring.
Well, I guess if you're cheating, you'd take it off, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And why would you take it off if you weren't planning to cheat? And why would you have a girlfriend and invite her out for the weekend if you weren't planning to cheat?
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't, it's not looking really good for the doctor here.
No, it's not. And either way, they're at the Ramada and she's with Laura with a suitcase full of purple clothes.
Not just at the Ramada. The Ramada in Oxnard.
In Oxnard. Oof. Yeah.
I don't even want to know.
She approaches the desk, tells the clerk she is Myrtle Groggins. Uses Myrtle. Myrtle.
It wasn't a believable name in Steel Trap.
No.
It's no better here.
And she says she's from the Society for the Preservation of Train Travel. She claims she spoke to someone earlier about one of their guests, Daniel Chalmers. And she then says that Daniel has been selected International Traveler of the Month.
I'm sorry. The line coming up. I couldn't help it. My mind just.
Yes.
And it always has with that line. Oh.
Ride our rails?
Yes. I'm sorry. From day one, the first time I heard that, it was like, ooh.
Yeah. So he's entitled to a free train trip to any city west of Chicago. She asks the clerk if he will be good enough to announce her. He's been selected International Traveler of the Month, but trains in North America, to my understanding, don't go across borders. So does this mean that she just, because he's from somewhere else and he's in the States, or how can you be International Traveler of the Month for a train?
Well, he's an international traveler, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the train ride he's getting is international.
No, it just.
But you're right. Weird. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to declare somebody the International Traveler of the Month if your service and what you're dedicated to, the preservation of train travel,
yeah,
if that's not international.
You'd just say Traveler of the Month, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, do we know for a fact that passenger trains don't, for example, cross from the U.S. into Canada? I don't know that.
I don't think. I don't know. I know we have a train line that goes coast to coast. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have any border, like trains across the border.
I know that it was announced a couple of years ago that the Alaska Railroad had come to some sort of an agreement with some Canadian entity to create a train line that would connect Alaska through Canada to the lower 48 states. I don't know whatever became of that agreement. I don't know the details of that agreement. I suppose I could have just dreamed it.
I just Googled it.
Okay.
I Googled it. Can you take a train from Canada to the U.S.? Is there a direct train between Canada and the United States? No. There is no direct train from Canada to the United States. However, there are services departing from Toronto Union Station and arriving at Chambers Street via 34 Street Penn Station. The journey includes transfers and takes approximately 13 hours and 47 minutes.
I just did a search as well.
Google, it's an amazing thing.
Yes, and it's so fortunate that I got lucky on this because I am so bad at Google searches. Google hates searches. Now, relying on Wikipedia, which, as we know, is Michael Scott's favorite source of information because anybody can write anything about anything, so you know it's absolutely the best information.
Yep.
It does say that the Alaska-Alberta Railroad, the Alaska-Alberta Railway Development Corporation, also known as A2A, was an entity created to build, own, and operate a proposed 2,600-kilometer railroad between Delta Junction and Fort McMurray.
Okay.
In 2021, the company was put into the receivership, and the project was put on hold due to financial irregularities between the A2A president and the main financial backer, Bridging Finance. So there's talk, there's plans, there's efforts, apparently. But
nothing, and definitely nothing in 1983 then.
Yeah.
So.
But even today, it looks like it's more of a scam than anything else.
Yeah, sounds like it. And they get on the elevator to check out the hotel room. And Laura says she's flattered that her mother came to her about what happened to her and not Frances. It's obvious that she sees this as an opportunity to connect with her mother. Abigail, however, passive-aggressively says, oh, she could never tell Frances about this because she and Donald are so happy together, and she could never relate to a loser in love. Is she trying to be cruel, or does she genuinely not understand how hurtful a comment like that is?
I don't have a good answer for that. I think it could just be, that's her personality. She's miserable, she's unhappy, and she's only happy if other people are also unhappy. So, yeah. I'm only happy when I'm unhappy, and I'm only happy when you're unhappy.
Yeah. Daniel congratulates him on what he clearly sees as a con, so he believes that Steele's current setup is just basically a long game of some sort. No?
I'm going to disagree.
Okay, go for it.
Well, I don't want to. It involves jumping ahead, and I'm not sure if I want to do that yet.
Jump ahead.
But, okay. As they're talking, he says, a lawyer in London owed me a favor or two. I called them in by having them recommend the Remington Steel Agency to Hoskins. We must keep this in the family. So that line is interesting by itself because you look at it and you say, okay, he's talking about Steel.
Yeah.
But later on, when Laura comes in and they're waltzing, she says, tell me about the man I euphemistically call Remington Steel. He doesn't bat an eye.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
He knows that she knows that he's not Remington Steel. So at various points through this, there are just little hints. Daniel says, you know, our paths. He's talking about Remington Steel. He says, our paths crossed occasionally and we kept in touch as best we can. I think Steel has been keeping Daniel up to date on what's been going on. I think Daniel knows everything about the situation.
I agree with you. I didn't mean con as in he thinks that Steel is conning Laura. I just mean a con as in Steel has found a part to play for a while. And this is, I mean, it's a larger con. It's conning the outside world, right? He's not Remington Steel. He's found a comfortable spot where he can live in a nice apartment and make good money and be revered. And, you know, people look up to him and they, so I guess maybe con is the wrong word, but.
I would have used the word situation.
Yeah. He sees Steel as.
Okay. I'll buy your explanation. I'll accept it.
Yeah. And Steele says,
you know, that's what happens when two people who speak the same language, you know, what's that saying?
Yeah, you know what? We're going to disagree too on things, which I think will be interesting.
Oh, no, we're not.
No, we will.
Well, I disagree with that.
Oh, fine. We'll just agree to disagree. It's totally fine. because it seems that Daniel does a similar thing that Steele does, in that he goes after people who he feels don't deserve to have whatever it is they have, or are cheating people or treating people badly. Mm-hmm. So is this where Steele gets his unique sense of morals from Daniel?
It could be, you know, and it's something that was actually in the first episode, the premiere episode, not the pilot.
Right. Yeah.
And you remember he was chasing two guys who had killed people, had stolen the royal labulite from the rightful owners. And he was there basically acting as a recovery guy. You know, like an insurance agency would hire somebody to go out and recover stolen merchandise. And that's basically what he was doing. So even the first time we met him, that was kind of the moral standard that he was operating from. And so, yeah, I think you're kind of right that he's targeting people, and he probably got this from Daniel, targeting people who are themselves dishonest, but who, let's see how to put this. The people that they are targeting, that Steele and Daniel are targeting, are dishonest people who have targeted other people in a more malicious manner.
Yes.
They kind of see themselves maybe a little bit as the Robin Hoods.
I even had that in my notes, real life Robin Hood ? Right. Because that's kind of what they're doing. I mean, they're doing it for themselves. Daniel wants the money for himself. He's not giving it to the poor.
But if you're stealing from a thief, is it really stealing? Yeah. Okay. That's a philosophy question that we won't get into, but I think that's kind of the premise that they're operating from.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess as well, if you steal from a thief, they're less likely to go to the police.
Oh, sure.
Right, because
although they might take you back into their office and congratulate you on your good fortune, and
and then shoot you in the head.
You're kind of right about letting Laura know, but at the same time, you know, we've noticed what a lousy undercover person, what a lousy actress Laura is. Do you think Steele hasn't noticed?
I mean, true, but one false step and she might get a bullet to the head too.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that Daniel and Steele are thinking that, okay, she's working for Hoskins. All she's doing is the detective work. She's not really involved in what's going to be the con. She is just she's just there as the hired help, basically, as far as Hoskins is concerned. And how would she even possibly know about the con?
Well, but she does find out.
Yeah, but I'm thinking at this point, their perspective is the fact that she's not part of the con, the fact that Hoskins came to her is a bit of protection for her.
True.
It's kind of weak, but I'm thinking
it's weak in the sense that Steele knows how good she is. And
yes,
I don't think.
Yeah, and that's kind of what undercover. I mean. Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, is that it's kind of weak because it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. Because she's going to figure him out.
Yeah. But at this point, that's apparently the best that they've got. And they don't want to let her know, because she's such a lousy actress when she's undercover, that would spill the beans. And that might even put her in greater danger.
I don't think that's why Steele doesn't want to let her know. I think he's afraid that if Laura comes face to face with his mentor, I don't think he's comfortable asking her to be part of a con. I think that whatever tenuous relationship they've built, he's afraid is going to come crashing down, because look what happened with Felicia. Ironically, the last time Abigail showed up.
But he asked her to go steal a painting with him.
He did, but this is his past. This is his own shady past, which, to be fair, Laura has never 100% been great about. She has always suspected him of whatever shady dealings, and made maybe made things up in her head as to things that he's done, or I think there's a moral element to it here that he's worried about losing respect from her or losing. I'm not even sure, but I don't think he's so private about his past that I don't think he wants to Laura to see it come walking through the door.
I'm going to say it could be either or both. I mean, you could absolutely be 100% right. You could be 50% right, and I'm 50% right, or I'm right. I don't know. I don't think we really get enough here to make that
we don't.
Final judgment. I still am more leaning toward the it's going to, she's already in the bad spot. Daniel's put her there. Yeah. And if we tell her, she's a bad enough actress, she's going to spill the beans, or she's going to make it obvious that there's something going on because she can't keep a poker face going on it. So she's going to be in less danger in this situation than if we told her and she blew it. But no, I can see what you're saying.
There's also the fact that any information that we, the audience, have gotten about his past has been information, as we know, that Steele has delivered to other people. Right. And Steele in the news, we got his backstory, or at least a chunk of it, but he delivered it to Agnes. Mm-hmm. And here, Laura finally gets that backstory, which comes later, but it's from Daniel.
But he doesn't give it to her. Daniel does. Yeah.
Right. So I think maybe he's worried that some of that will come out because he doesn't want her to know it. We've seen that. If he did, he'd have told her. Right. But maybe there's some shame associated with the fact that he was young and angry and on the streets and not as polished and sort of stylish and charming as he is now. Who knows?
Well, I think he probably realizes she
about her.
I think he probably realizes that Laura could piece some of that together already from what she knows.
Yeah.
Or make some assumptions based on what she knows. And that he probably wouldn't have gone into that much detail. You're absolutely right. He probably wouldn't have gone that far back into the past. So,
and, I mean,
you know, I don't think really Laura, when Laura asked Daniel about his past, I don't think Laura was intending for him to go that far in the past either. I think she was looking more about him as an adult, as a con man adult.
Yeah.
And that the fact that Daniel chose to take it all the way back to the beginning, that's an interesting question too.
Yeah. We'll get there. Why do they continue to buzz the doorbell when he's already told them he'll be a minute? That drives me nuts. They just keep buzzing. Like, come on. He answered
you. Some people do that. Some people do that. I guess they figure that if they keep pushing it, it's going to spur you on to be faster and get to the door quicker. You know, it's like people who go to the street corner and they want to use the crosswalk, and so they'll hit the button and then they'll sit there and just pound, 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 pound on it, not realizing that most of those buttons aren't even connected.
They don't even work. They're
placebos in most places.
So yeah, they come in.
But they feel good about it.
They do. He liked to press a button. She brings him into the kitchen, only to be startled by Chalmers, who says he is here to brew a spot of tea for a sick friend. And he introduces himself as Colonel Reginald Frobisher of the 10th Royal Hussars.
Error does not compute.
Yeah. I was going to say, did you?
that part could buy. I could buy that. But then he says that Steele was a comrade. And the implication is he was a comrade in the 10th. Yeah. And Steele says, yes, shiny 10th. No. Well, first of all, there is a note in Judith's book that says that Daniel's pretense of being in the 10th Royal Hussars was based on Gareth Davies' real-life army regiment. Okay. I did a little research on the 10th Royal Hussars, which is Prince of Wales' own.
Yes.
It was a cavalry regiment of the British Army raised in 1715. It saw service for three centuries, including the First World War and Second War.
Yeah.
But then was amalgamated into the 11th Hussars, which was Prince Albert's own, to form the Royal Hussars in October of 1969. In
Yes.
1969. If we use Brosnan's age as Steele's age, he would have been 16 when the 10th was dissolved.
Yeah.
Whoops. Sorry. Error. Math error. Does not compute.
That was exactly what I had. I had the history of the Royal Hussars, and then I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't work. So, yeah.
But, hey, they didn't have Wikipedia back then, so, you know, Lauren couldn't look it up that easily. So,
but she knows that Chalmers is feeding her a line, yes. Especially when he says he's there to relive their adventures in the Punjab. He refers to Steele as the lieutenant. So, bonus points, though, for pronouncing the word lieutenant correctly. I'm just going to say it.
Well, let's not. Okay, let's ignore the fact that when you type out the word or you spell it out, there is no F in it. There's no PH in it. But we'll ignore that for the time being. But yes, you're right. He did pronounce it in the proper British pronunciation.
/ Canadian way. We say lieutenant too. Just saying. Chalmers gives Steele the rundown on Hoskins, saying he hates Americans and is fanatical about soccer, especially Manchester. Now, here's the thing. Here's a couple of ways you can tell this is written by an American, and it's not an insult. I'm just saying in general. Daniel would say soccer, sure, because Daniel is not British. So that I can buy.
Well, in this context, he would. Although I think Daniel is supposed to be British. But here he's portraying an American, so he would say soccer, yes.
And then, okay, so he doesn't specify which Manchester team. This is another reason you can tell that this was written by an American. There's two teams in Manchester. There's Manchester United, and there's Man City. Now, granted, Man City
was... Did Man City exist back then?
Yes, it did. Okay. So Man City, at the end of that season, were relegated, but they were in the first division at that time. So this would still be a question that Steele would probably say, okay, which Manchester? Or Daniel would have to say Man U, because Man City was a team. They were in the first division at the end of 1983. They were what's called relegated, pushed down a division to the second division. The premiership didn't exist at this point, so it was just called the first division. But you can tell I have a husband that's from the UK. So this would have been a logical question for Steele to ask, and or they should have specified which team. Anyway.
Is he a man? Is your husband a Man United fan?
No, he hates Man U. But Man U is one of those teams where you either really, really love them or you can't stand them. And he's in the latter camp. But we were watching the Man City game yesterday, and I think Man City won. So this would have been a question that would have been necessary to ask. And I've got some more soccer football issues.
Well, and the thing is, yeah, you're right that here Daniel used the American term because he's portraying an American at this point.
Yes.
But, yeah, Hoskins and Johnny Todd, a.k.a. Remington Steele, all should have been using the word football.
Football, yeah.
Not soccer. And,
yeah.
You know, if they needed to specify English football.
Yes.
Yeah, because they come close to later in the episode, but.
Yeah. Yeah, they would say football, or they'd say footy even, because footy is an abbreviation that's very common. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Steele approaches Hoskins and the other. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting through this sequence here. Daniel Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.'s. He does when he was doing the British accent as Reginald Frobisher and as Daniel Chalmers himself, it wasn't a heavy British accent, but you could tell it was pretty light, but it was there. And here he's doing a very good American accent for a Brit. You know, and so he just throws in enough.
So this is a question I have later, but I'm going to ask it now since we're on the topic.
Okay.
Daniel Chalmers has a Canadian passport. It says Daniel Chalmers, Canada. When he's doing the British accent as Colonel Reginald Frobisher, he sounds very British. When he's speaking as Daniel Chalmers, he sounds Canadian. I don't hear any British in that at all. Okay, so well, I think the slight difference in accents you're picking up are Canadian versus American.
Okay, and that may be what I'm
yeah
meaning there. To me, most, I mean, there's some words that I can tell when I'm talking to a Canadian, but usually it's very subtle, and there's only certain words where I can pick it up. Yeah, and that may be what I'm hearing here.
He does do a good American accent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Evram Zimbalist Jr. does a pretty good job of the various inflections of the various accents that he's supposed to be affecting at the time. He does. So kudos to EZ.
You can tell he's classically trained as an actor. Like there's elements there that are very polished. Hoskins latches onto the name Jack Todd and is suddenly very interested in what's going on. Now, I looked and I asked Scott,
because
Scott knows everything there is to know about soccer, football, and asked, was there ever, because they claim he was the best goalkeeper in the first division. We couldn't find any evidence of a Jack Todd in the first division at the time he would have played at.
The source I found, and I wish I had made note of it, I didn't. I found a listing of all the players on Man U since, I think it was like the 1960s.
Yeah.
And the name Jack Todd did not show up anywhere.
No. No, it didn't.
Because, you know, presumably Jack Todd, being Johnny Todd's uncle, could have played, you know, when Johnny Todd was just a wee lad.
Yes. Yeah.
But
I looked back.
But yeah, nothing.
No. So this is obviously a name they've invented, because I was curious. I was like, and then I asked, when I couldn't find anything, I asked Scott, I was like, was there ever a goalkeeper that played for Man U in like the 60s or even earlier than that named Jack Todd? And he was like, not that I'm aware of. And he looked it up and we couldn't find anything. So I'm assuming it's a fake name.
Hey, everybody, Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating?
Oh, yeah. Yes, every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.